7. Locke and Jean threw themselves backward from Requin's balcony 10 minutes later, demi-silk lines leading from their leather belts to the perfect anchor-noose knots they'd tied on the railing. There hadn't been enough room in the chairs for belay lines, but sometimes you couldn't get anywhere in life without taking little risks. Locke hollered as they slid rapidly down through the night air, past balcony after balcony, window after window of bored, satisfied, incurious, or jaded gamers. His glee had temporarily wrestled his sorrow down. He and Jean fell for 20 seconds, using their iron descenders to avoid a headlong plummet, and for those 20 seconds all was right with the world, Crooked Warden be praised. 10 of Requin's prized paintings, lovingly trimmed from their frames, rolled up and stuffed into oilcloth carrying tubes, were slung over his shoulder. He'd had to leave 2 on the wall for lack of carrying cases, but once again space in the chairs had been limited. After Locke had conceived the idea of going after Requin's fairly well-known art collection, he'd nosed around for a potential buyer among the antiquities and diversions merchants of several cities. The price he'd eventually been offered for his hypothetical acquisition of the art objects had been gratifying, to say the least. Their slide ended on the stones of Requin's courtyard, where the ends of their lines hung 3 inches above the ground. Their landing disturbed several drunk couples strolling the perimeter of the yard. No sooner were they shrugging out of their lines and harnesses than they heard the rush of heavily booted feet and the clatter of arms and armour. A squad of 8 eyes ran toward them from the street side of the Sinspire.
"Stand where you are," the eye in the lead bellowed. "As an officer of Archon and Council, I place you under arrest for crimes against Tal'Varar. Raise your hands and offer no struggle, or no quarter will be given."
8. The long, shallow draft boat drew up against the Archon's private landing, and Locke found his heart hammering. Now came the delicate part, the ever-so-delicate part. He and Jean were thrust from the boat by the eyes surrounding them. Their hands were tied behind their backs, and they'd been relieved of their paintings. Those were carried very carefully by the last of the arresting eyes to step off the boat. The arresting officer stepped up to the eye in command of the landing and saluted.
"We're to take the prisoners to see the Protector immediately, Sword Prefect."
"I know," said the landing officer, an unmistakable note of satisfaction in his voice. "Well done, Sergeant."
"Thank you, sir. The gardens?"
"Yes." Locke and Jean were marched through the Mon Magisteria, through empty hallways and past silent ballrooms, through the smells of weapon oil and dusty corners. At last they emerged into the Archon's gardens. Their feet crunched on the gravel of the path as they made their way through the deeply scented night, past the faint glow of silver creeper and the stuttering luminescence of lantern beetles. Maxilan Stragos sat waiting for them near his boathouse, on a chair brought out for the occasion. With him were Meraine and, oh, how Locke's heart quickened, the bald alchemist, as well as 2 more eyes. The arresting eyes, led by their sergeant, saluted the Archon. "On their knees," said Stragos casually, and Locke and Jean were forced down to the gravel before him. Locke winced and tried to take in the details of the scene. Meraine wore a long-sleeved tunic and a dark skirt. From his angle, Locke could see that her boots weren't courtly fripperies, but black, flat-soled field boots, good for running and fighting. Interesting. Stragos Alchemist stood with a large grey satchel, looking nervous. Locke's pulse quickened once again at the thought of what might be in that bag. "Stragos," said Locke, pretending that he didn't know exactly what was on the Archon's mind. "Another garden party? Your armoured jackasses can untie us now. I doubt there are agents of the Priori lurking in the trees." "I have sometimes wondered to myself," said Stragos, "precisely what it would take to humble you." He beckoned the eye at his right side forward. "I have regretfully concluded that it's probably impossible." The eye kicked Locke in the chest, knocking him backward. Gravel slid beneath him as he tried to squirm away. The eye reached down and yanked him back up by his tunic collar. "Do you see, my alchemist, here as you requested?" said Stragos.
"Yes,"
said Locke. "That's what you get, all you will ever get. I have kept my word. Enjoy your useless glimpse."
"Stragos, you bastard, we still have work to do for..."
"I think not," said the Archon. "I think your work is already done. And at long last, I think I can see precisely why you so aggravated the bonds, Magi, that they passed you into my care."
"Stragos, if we don't get back to the Poison Orchid..."
"My spotters have reported a ship answering that description, anchored to the north of the city. I'll be out to fetch her soon enough, with half the galleys in my fleet. And then I'll have another pirate to parade through the streets, and a crew to drop into the midden deep, one by one, while all of Tal Vahrar cheers me on."
"But we..."
"You have given me what I need," said Stragos, "if not in the manner in which you intended. Sergeant, did you encounter any difficulty in securing these prisoners from the Sin Spire?"
"Requin refused to allow us entry to the structure, Protector."
"Requin refused to allow you entry to the structure," said Stragos, clearly savoring each word, "thereby treating an informal tradition as though it had any precedence over my legal authority, thereby giving me cause to send my troops in platoons and do what the bought and paid for constables won't, throw that bastard in a box until we find out just how long he's willing to stay quiet about the activities of his good friends the Priori. Now I have my fighting chance. There's no need for you two to cause further violence in my waters."
"Stragos, you motherfucker!"
"In fact," said the Archon, "there's no need for you two at all."
"We had a deal!"
"And I would have kept to it, had you not scorned me in the one matter which could brook no disobedience." Stragos rose from his chair, shaking with anger.
"My instructions were to leave the men and women at Windward Rock alive, alive."
"But we..." began Locke, absolutely mystified. "We used the Whitfrost, and we did leave them..."
"With their throats cut," said Stragos. "Only the two on the roof lived. I presume you were too lazy to climb up and finish them off."
"We didn't!"
"Who else was raiding my island that night, Costa? It's not exactly a shrine for pilgrims, is it? If you didn't do it, you allowed the prisoners to do it. Either way, the fault is yours."
"Stragos, I honestly don't know what you're talking about."
"That won't bring my four good men and women back, will it?" Stragos put his hands behind his back. "And with that, we're done. The sound of your voice, the tone of your arrogance, the sheer effrontery contained within that tongue of yours. You are shark skin on my eardrums, Master Costa, and you murdered honest soldiers of Tal Vahrar. You will have no priest, no ceremony, and no grave. Sergeant, give me your sword."
The sergeant of the arresting eyes stepped forward and drew his blade. He turned it hilt first toward the Archon.
"Stragos," said Jean, "one last thing."
Locke turned toward him and saw that he was smiling thinly.
"I'm going to remember this moment for the rest of my god's damned life."
"I..."
Stragos never finished his sentence, since the eye sergeant suddenly drew back his sword arm and slammed the hilt of the weapon into the Archon's face. 9. They did it like this. The eyes removed Locke and Jean from Requin's courtyard and shoved them into a heavy carriage with iron-barred windows. Three entered the compartment with them, two rode up top to tend the horses, and three stood at the sides and rear as outriders. At the end of the street atop the highest tier of the golden steps, where the carriage had to turn left to take the switchblade ramp down to the next level, another carriage suddenly blocked its way. The eyes yelled threats. The driver of the other carriage apologized profusely and shouted that his horses were uncommonly stubborn. Then the crossbow strings began to snap, and the drivers and outriders toppled from their places, caught defenseless in a storm of quarrels. Squads of constables in full uniform appeared on the street to either side of the carriage, waving their staves and shields. "Move along!" they shouted at the wide-eyed bystanders, the wisest of whom had already ducked for cover. "Nothing to see here! Business of Archon and Council!" As the bodies hit the cobblestones outside the carriage, the door flew open and the three inside made a futile attempt to aid their fallen comrades. Two more squads of constables, with help from a number of private individuals in plain dress who just happened to get involved at the same signal, charged and overpowered them. One fought back so hard that he was slain by accident. The other two were soon forced down beside the carriage and their bronze masks removed. Leonis Cordo appeared, wearing the uniform of an eye, complete in every detail save for the mask. He was followed by seven more men and women in nearly complete costumes. With them was a young woman Locke didn't recognize. She knelt in front of the two captured eyes.
"You, I don't know," she said to the one on the right.
Before the man had time to realize what was happening, a constable had passed a dagger across his throat and shoved him to the ground. Other constables were quickly dragging the rest of the bodies out of sight.
"You," said the woman, regarding the sole surviving eye. "Lucius Corlys, you I know."
"Kill me now," said the man. "I'll give you nothing."
"Of course," said the woman. "But you have a mother and a sister who works in the Black Hands Crescent, and you have a brother by bonding on the fishing boats and two nephews."
"Fuck you," Corlys said. "You wouldn't."
"While you watched, I would. I will. Every single one of them, and you'll be in the room the whole time, and they'll know that you could save them with a few words."
Corlys looked at the ground and began to sob.
"Please," he said, "let this stay between us."
"Tal Vahrar remains, Corlys. The Archon isn't Tal Vahrar. But I don't have time to play games with you. Answer my questions or we will find your family."
"Gods forgive me," said Corlys, nodding.
"Were you given any special code phrases or procedures to use when re-entering the Mon Magisteria?"
No.
"What exactly were the orders that you heard given to your sergeant?"
When the brief interrogation was over and Corlys carted off, alive to keep him in fear of consequences should he be leaving anything out, along with the bodies, the false eyes armed themselves with the weapons and harnesses of the real thing and drew on the brass masks. Then the carriage was off again, speeding on its way to the boat waiting at the inner docks, lest any of Stragos' agents should get across the bay in time to warn of what they'd seen.
"That was about as good as we could hope for,"
said Leonis, sitting inside the carriage with them.
"How good are those fake uniforms?" asked Locke.
"Fake? You misunderstand. The uniforms weren't the hard part. Our sympathizers in Stragos' forces supplied us with these some time ago. It's the masks that are damned difficult. One per eye, no spares. They keep them like family heirlooms, and they spend so much time looking at them even a close copy would be noticed."
Cordo held up his mask and grinned. "After tonight, hopefully, we'll never see the damned things again. Now what the hell is in those oilcloth tubes?"
"A gift from Requin," said Locke. "Unrelated personal business."
"You know Requin well?"
"We share a taste for the art of the late Therin Throne period," said Locke, smiling. "In fact, we've even exchanged some pieces of work recently."
10. As Leonis knocked the Archon to the ground, the other false eyes tore their masks off and took action. Locke and Jean slid out of the purely decorative knots at their wrists in less than a second. One of Leonis' men underestimated the skills of the real eye he faced. He fell to his knees with most of his left side sliced open. Two more Priori pretenders closed in and harried the eye until his guard slipped. They knocked him down and stabbed him several times. The other tried to run and fetch aid, but was slain before he could take five steps. Meraine and the alchemist looked around, the alchemist far more nervously than Meraine, but two of Leone's people put them at sword point.
"Well, Stragos," said Leonis, hauling the Archon back to his knees. "Warmest regards from the House of Cordo."
He raised his arm, sword reversed to strike, and grinned. Jean grabbed him from behind, threw him to the ground, and stood over him, seething.
"The deal, Cordo."
"Yeah," said Leonis, still smiling where he lay on the ground. "Well, it's like this. You've done us quite a service, but we don't feel comfortable having loose ends running around. And there are now seven of us and two of..."
"You amateur double-crossers," said Locke. "You make us professionals cringe. You think you're so fucking clever. I saw this coming about 100 miles away, so I had a mutual friend offer an opinion on the subject."
Locke reached into his boot and pulled out a slightly crumpled, moderately sweaty half-sheet of parchment, folded into quarters. Locke passed this to Leonis and smiled, knowing as the Priori unfolded it that he would read, "I would take it as a personal affront if the bearers of this note were to be harmed or hindered in any way, engaged as they are upon an errand of mutual benefit. The extension of every courtesy to them will be noted and returned as though a courtesy to myself. They bear my full and absolute trust. R." All, of course, above Requin's personal seal.
"I know that you yourself are not fond of his chance house," said Locke. "But you must admit that the same is not generally true among the Priori, and many of your peers keep a great deal of money in his vault."
"Enough. I take your point."
Cordo rose to his feet and all but threw the letter back at Locke.
"What do you ask?"
"I only want two things," said Locke. "The Archon and his alchemist. What you do with this god's damned city is entirely your business."
"The Archon must..."
"You were about to gut him like a fish. He's my business now. Just know that whatever happens to him won't be an inconvenience for you."
The sound of shouting arose from the other side of the gardens. No, Locke corrected himself, the other side of the fortress.
"What the hell is that?" he asked.
"We have sympathizers at the Mon Magisteria's gate," said Cordo. "We're bringing people in to prevent anyone from leaving. They must be making their presence known."
"If you try to storm..."
"We're not storming the Mon Magisteria, just sealing it off. Once the troops inside comprehend the new situation, we're confident they'll accept the authority of the councils."
"You'd better hope that's the case across Tal Vahrar," said Locke. "But enough of this shit. Hey, Stragos, let's go have a chat with your pet alchemist."
Jean hoisted the Archon, still clearly in shock, to his feet, and began to haul him over to where Meraine and the alchemist were standing under guard.
"You," said Locke, pointing at the bald man, "are about to start explaining a hell of a lot of things, if you know what's good for you."
The alchemist shook his head.
"Oh, but I...
"Pay close attention," said Locke. "This is the end of the Arcanate, understand? The whole institution is getting sunk in the harbour once and for all tonight. After this, Maxilan Stragos won't have the power to buy a cup of warm piss for all the gold in Tal Vahrar. That will leave you with nobody to go crawling to as you spend the rest of your short, miserable life answering to the two men you fucking poisoned. Do you have a permanent antidote?"
I carry an antidote for every poison I use in the Archon service, yes, just in case."
"Xandrin, don't!" said Stragos.
Jean punched him in the stomach.
"Oh, no. Do, Xandrin, do," said Locke.
The bald man reached into his satchel and held up a glass vial full of transparent liquid.
"One dose is what I carry.
This is enough for one man. Do not split it. This will cleanse the substance from the humours and channels of the body.
Locke took the vial from him, his hand trembling. And this? How much will it cost to have another alchemist make more?
It's impossible, said Xandrin. I designed the antidote to defy reactive analysis. Any sample subjected to alchemical scrutiny will be ruined. The poison and its antidote are my proprietary formulation.
Notes, said Locke. Recipes, whatever you call the damn things.
In my head, said Xandrin. Paper is a poor keeper of secrets.
Well then, said Locke, until you cook us up another dose, it looks like you're fucking well coming with us. Do you like the sea?
11. Meraine made her decision then. If the antidote couldn't be duplicated and she could knock the vial to the ground, the troublesome anomalies Costa and Deferra were as good as dead. That would leave only Stragos and Xandrin. If they were dealt with, all those with any direct knowledge of the fact that she served a master beyond Tal Vahrar would be silenced. She moved her right arm slightly, dropping the hilt of her poisoned dagger into her hand, and took a deep breath. Meraine moved so fast that the false eye standing to her side never even had the chance to raise his sword. Her sideways stab, not preceded by any telltale glance or lunge, took him in the side of the neck. She slid the blade sideways as she withdrew, tearing whatever she could in case the poison took a few extra seconds to do its work.
12. Meraine's first victim had just uttered a gasp of surprise when she moved again, slashing across the back of Xandrin's neck with a knife she'd produced from nowhere. Locke stared for a split second, startled. He counted himself fast, but if she'd been aiming for him, he realized that he never would have seen the blow coming in time. As Xandrin cried out and stumbled forward, Meraine kicked at Locke, a fast attack rather than a solid one. She caught his arm and the vial flew from his fingers. Locke barely had time to yell, "Shit!" before he was diving after it, heedless of the gravel he was about to skin himself against or anything else Meraine might care to do to him. He plucked the still intact vial off the ground, uttered a whisper of thanks, and was then knocked aside as Jean rushed past, arms extended. As he hit the ground with the vial clutched to his chest, Locke saw Meraine wind up and hurl her knife. Jean struck her at the moment of release, so that rather than impaling Stragos through the neck or chest, as she'd clearly intended, she bounced her blade off the gravel at his feet. The Archon flinched away from the weapon nonetheless. Meraine, improbably, put up an effective struggle against Jean. She freed one arm from his grasp somehow and elbowed him in the ribs. Lithe and no doubt desperate as all hell, she kicked his left foot, broke his grip, and tried to stumble away. Jean retained enough of a hold on her tunic to tear off her left sleeve all the way to the shoulder. Thrown off balance as it gave way, he fell to the ground. Locke caught a flash of an elaborate dark tattoo against the pale skin of Meraine's upper arm, something like a grapevine entwined around a sword. Then she was off like a crossbow bolt, darting into the night, away from Jean and the false eyes who chased her in vain for a few dozen steps before giving up and swearing loudly.
"Well, what the... oh, hell!" said Locke,
noticing for the first time that the false eye Meraine had stabbed, along with Xandrin, was writhing on the ground with rivulets of foaming saliva trickling from the corners of his mouth.
"Oh, shit! Shit! Hell!"
Locke shouted, bending helplessly over the dying alchemist. The convulsions ceased in just a few seconds, and Locke stared down at the single vial of antidote in his hands, a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach.
"No," said Jean from behind him. "Oh, gods, why did she do that?"
"I don't know," said Locke.
"What the hell do we do?"
"We... shit! Damned if I know that either."
"You should."
"Nobody's doing anything," said Locke. "I'll keep this safe. Once this is over, we'll sit down with it, have dinner, talk it over. We'll come up with something."
"You can..." "Time to go,"
said Locke, lowering his voice to an urgent whisper.
Get what we came here for and go, before things get more complicated.
Before troops loyal to the Archon notice that he's having a bad night. Before Leonis finds out that Requin is actually hunting for us as we speak. Before some other god's damned surprise crawls out of the ground to bite us on the ass.
Cordo! He shouted. Where's that bag you promised?
Leonis gestured to one of his surviving false eyes, and the woman passed a heavy burlap sack to Locke. Locke shook it out. It was wider than he was, and nearly 6 feet long.
Well, Maxillan, he said, I offered you the chance to forget all of this, and let us go, and keep what you had. But you had to be a fucking asshole, didn't you?
Custer, said Stragos, at least seeming to recover his voice. I can give you...
You can't give me a god's damned thing.
Stragos seemed to be thinking of making an attempt for Meraine's dagger, so Locke gave it a hard kick. It skittered across the gravel and into the darkness of the gardens.
Those of us in our profession, those who hold with the Crooked Warden, have a little tradition we follow when someone close to us dies. In this case, someone who got killed as a result of this mad fucking scheme of yours.
Custer, don't throw away what I can offer.
We call it a death offering, said Locke. Means we steal something of value, proportional to the life we lost. Except in this case, I don't think there's anything in the world that qualifies. But we're doing our best.
Jean stepped up beside him and cracked his knuckles.
Ezra del Mastro, he said very quietly, I give you the Archon of Tal Verar.
He punched Stragos so hard that the Archon's feet left the gravel. In a moment, he was stuffing the unconscious old man into the burlap sack. Another moment, and the sack was tied off and slung over his shoulders like a bag of potatoes.
Well, Leonis, said Locke, best of luck with your revolution, or whatever the hell it is. We're sneaking out of here before things have a chance to get any more interesting on us.
And Stragos?
You'll never see him again, said Locke.
Good enough, then. Are you leaving the city?
Not half fast enough for our god's damned taste.
13. Jean dumped him on the quarterdeck, under the eyes of Zamira and all the surviving crew. It had been a long and arduous trip back, first to retrieve their backpacks from Cordo's little boat, and then to dutifully retrieve Drakasha's ship's boat, and then to row nearly out to sea. But it had all been worth it. The entire night had been worth it, Locke decided, just to see the expression on Stragos' face when he found Zamira standing over him.
Drakasha,
he mumbled, then spit one of his teeth onto the deck. Blood ran in several streams down his chin.
Maxillan Stragos, former Archon of Tal Verar, she said. Final Archon of Tal Verar. Last time I saw you, my perspective was somewhat different.
As was mine, he sighed. What now?
There are too many debts riding on your carcass to buy them off with death, said Zamira. We thought long and hard about this. We've decided that we're going to try to keep you around as long as we possibly can.
She snapped her fingers, and Jabril stepped forward, carrying a mass of sturdy, if slightly rusted, iron chains and cuffs in his arms. He dropped them on the deck next to Stragos and laughed as the old man jumped. The hands of other crewfolk seized him, and he began to sob in disbelief as his legs and arms were clamped and as the chains were draped around him.
You're going in the orlop, Stragos. You're going into the dark, and we're going to treat it as a special privilege to carry you around with us wherever we go, in any weather, in any sea, in any heat. We're going to haul you a mighty long way. You and your irons. Long after your clothes fall off, I guarantee, you'll still have those to wear.
Drakasha, please!
Throw him as far down as we got, she said, and half a dozen crewfolk began carrying him toward a main deck hatch. "Chain him to the bulkhead, then let him get cozy."
"Drakasha!"
he screamed.
"You can't! You can't! I'll go mad!"
"I know," she said, "and you'll scream. Gods, how you'll wail down there. But that's okay. We can always do with a bit of music at sea." Then he was carried below the poison orchid's deck to the rest of his life. "Well," said Drakasha, turning to Locke and Jean, "you two delivered. I'll be damned, but you got what you wanted."
"No, Captain," said Jean. "We got what we went after, mostly. But we didn't get what we wanted. Not by a long God's damned shot."
"I'm sorry, Jerome," she said.
"I hope nobody ever calls me that again," said Jean. "The name is Jean."
"Locke and Jean," she said. "All right, then. Can I take you to somewhere?"
"Velverazzo, if you don't mind," said Locke. "We've got some business to transact."
"And then you'll be rich men?"
"We'll be in funds, yes. Do you want some for your..."
"No," she said. "You went into Talvera and did the stealing. Keep it. We've got swag enough from Salon Corbeau, and so few ways to split it now. We'll be fine."
"So what will you do after that?"
"We had a plan," said Locke.
"Remember what you told me at the rail that night? If someone tries to draw lines around your ship, just set more sail?"
Drakasha nodded.
"I guess you could say we're going to give it a try," said Locke.
"Will you need anything else, then?"
"Well," said Locke, "for safety's sake, given our past history, perhaps you'd let us consider borrowing one of your ship's cats?"
14. They met the next day, at Requin's invitation, in what could only be described as the wreckage of his office. The main door was smashed off its hinges, the suite of chairs still lay broken across the floor, and of course almost all of the paintings on the walls had been sliced out of their frames. Requin seemed to derive a perverse pleasure in seating the 7 priori on fine chairs in the midst of the chaos, and pretending that all was perfectly normal. Selendri paced the room behind the guests.
"Has everything gone more smoothly for you ladies and gentlemen since last night?" asked Requin.
"Fighting's ended in the Sword Marina," said Jacantha Tiga, youngest of the inner 7. "The navy is on the leash."
"The Mon Magisteria is ours," said Leonis Cordo, standing in for his father. "All of Stragos' captains are in custody, except for 2 captains of intelligence."
"We can't have another fucking Ravel incident," said a middle-aged priori.
"I've got people working on that issue myself," said Requin. "They won't go to ground within the city, I can promise that much."
"The ambassadors from Talisham, Espara, and the Kingdom of the 7 Marrows have publicly expressed confidence in the leadership of the council," said Tiga.
"I know," said Requin, smiling. "I forgave them some rather substantial debts last night, and suggested that they might make themselves useful to the new regime. Now, what about the eyes?"
"About half of them are alive and in custody," said Cordo. "The rest are dead, with just a few thought to be trying to stir up resistance."
"They won't get far," said Tiga. "Loyalty to the old Arcanate won't buy food or beer. I expect they'll turn up dead here and there once they annoy the regulars too much."
"We'll have the rest quietly gotten rid of over the next few days," said Cordo.
"Now, I wonder," said Requin, "if that's really so very wise. The eyes of the Archon represent a significant pool of highly trained and committed people. Surely there's got to be a better use for them than filling graves."
"They were loyal to Stragos alone."
Or perhaps to tell Varah, were you to ask them?
Requin placed a hand over his heart.
My patriotic duty compels me to point this out.
Cordo snorted. They were his shock troops, his bodyguards, his torturers. They're useless to us, if not actively seditious.
Perhaps, for all of his vaunted military understanding, our dear departed Archon employed the eyes inefficiently, said Requin. Perhaps the business with the faceless masks was too much. They might have been better off in plain clothes, as an enhancement to his intelligence apparatus, rather than terrorizing people as his enforcers.
Maybe for his sake, said Tiga. Had he done so, that intelligence apparatus might have foiled our move against him yesterday. It was a close thing.
Still, said Cordo, hard to keep a kingdom when you no longer have a king.
Yes, said Tiga. We're all so very impressed, Cordo. Subtly mention your involvement in passing as often as you like, please.
At least I...
And more difficult still to keep a kingdom, interrupted Requin, when you discard perfectly good tools left behind by the king.
Forgive us our density, said Saravel Fioran, a woman nearly as old as Marius Cordo. But what precisely are you driving at, Requin?
Merely that the eyes, properly vetted and retrained, could be a significant asset to Tal Varah, if used not as shock troops, but as a secret constabulary?
Says the man in charge of the very people such a force would be charged with hunting down, scoffed Cordo.
Younger Cordo, said Requin, those are also the very people whose interference with your family business is kept to an acceptable minimum through my involvement. They are the very people who were instrumental in delivering our victory yesterday, carrying your messages, filling the streets to detain army reinforcements, distracting Stragos' most loyal officers while some of you were allowed to approach this affair with the air of amateurs dabbling at lawn bowling.
Not I, said Cordo.
No, not you. You did fight, but I flaunt my hypocrisy with a smile on my face, Leonis. Don't you dare pretend, here in our highest privacy, that your disdain somehow absolves you for your involvement with the likes of me. You don't want to imagine a city with crime unregulated by the likes of me. As for the eyes, I am not asking, I am telling. Those few who were true fanatics for Stragos can conveniently trip and land on swords, yes. The rest are too useful to throw away.
On what grounds, said Tiga, do you presume to lecture?
On the grounds that 6 of the 7 people sitting here have seen fit to store goods and funds at the Sinspire vault. Items that, let us be frank, need not ever reappear in the event that I begin to feel anxious about our relationship. I have an investment in this city, the same as you. I would not take kindly to having a foreign power interrupt my affairs. To give Stragos his due, I cannot imagine that the army and navy in your hands will inspire a great deal of awe in our enemies, given what happened last time the Priori governed during a war. Therefore, I see fit to hedge all of our bets.
Surely we could discuss this in just a few days, said Leonis.
I think not. Inconveniences like our surviving eyes have a habit of disappearing before arguments can broaden, don't they? It's a busy time. Messages might be lost or misconstrued, and I'm sure there'd be a perfectly plausible reason for whatever happened.
So what do you want? Asked Fioran.
If you're going to take the Mon Magisteria as an administrative centre for our shiny new government, I would imagine that a suite of offices would be a good start.
something nice and prestigious, before all the nice ones are gone. Plus, I'll expect a rudimentary operating budget by the end of the week. I'll set down the rough finicking myself. Salaries for the next year. Speaking of which, I will expect at least 3 or 4 positions within the hierarchy of this new organization to be placed entirely at my discretion. Salaries in the range of 10 to 15 solari per annum.
So you can pass out sinecures to some of your jumped-up thieves, said Leonis.
So I can aid them in their transition to life as respectable citizens and defenders of Tal Vahrar, yes, said Requin.
Will this be your own transition to life as a respectable citizen? Asked Tiga.
Here I thought I already was, said Requin. Gods, no. I have no desire to turn away from the responsibilities I currently enjoy. But it just so happens that I have an ideal candidate in mind to head our new organization. Someone who shares my qualms about the manner in which Stragos employed his eyes, and should be taken all the more seriously for the fact that she used to be one.
Selendri couldn't help smiling as the priori turned in their seats to stare at her.
"Now, Requin, hold on," said Cordo.
"I see no need," said Requin. "I don't believe your 6 fellows are actually going to deny me this very minor and very patriotic request, are they?"
Cordo looked around, and Selendri knew what he was seeing on the faces of the other priori. If he formally tried to stop this, he would be alone, and he would weaken not only his father's borrowed position, but his own future prospects.
"I think her starting compensation should be something handsome, rather handsome," said Requin cheerfully. "And of course she'll require use of official carriages and barges, an official residence. Stragos had dozens of houses and manors at his disposal. Oh, and I think her office at the Mon Magisteria should be the nicest and most prestigious of all. Don't you?"
They kissed one another for a very long time, alone in the office once the priori had left in various states of bemusement, worry, and aggravation. As he usually did, Requin removed his gloves to run the brown, pocked skin of his hands over her, over the matching scar tissue on her left-hand side, as well as the healthy flesh on her right.
"There you are, my dear," he said. "I know you've been chafing here for some time, running up and down these tower steps, fetching and bowing for drunkards of quality."
"I'm still sorry for my failure to—"
"Our failure was entirely shared," said Requin. "In fact, I fell for Costa and De Ferra's line of bullshit harder than you did. You retained your suspicion the whole way. Left to your own devices, you would have thrown them out the window early on and avoided the entire mess at the end, I'm sure."
She smiled.
"And those smirking priori assume I'm inflicting one last grand sinecure on them where you're concerned." Requin ran his fingers through her hair. "Gods, are they in for a surprise? I can't wait to see you in action. You'll build something that will make my little coteries of Felantotsi look tawdry."
Selendri stared around at the wreckage of the office. Requin laughed.
"I suppose," he said, "that I have to admire the audacious little shits. To spend 2 years planning such a thing, and then the business with the chairs, and with my seal. My, Leonis was throwing a fit."
"I'd have thought you'd be furious," said Selendri.
"Furious? I suppose I am. I was rather fond of that suite of chairs."
"I know how long you worked to acquire those paintings."
"Ah, the paintings, yes." Requin grinned mischievously. "Well, as for that, the walls have been left somewhat under-decorated.
How would you like to go down to the vault with me to start fetching out the real ones?
What do you mean, the real ones?